welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our guest author is Raymond Ibrahim, Defenders of the West, the Christian Heroes Who Stood Against Islam, published by Bombardier Books, available through our EWTN religious catalog. Raymond, it's a pleasure to have you on this program.
Good to be with you, Doug.
A lot of our audience would recall seeing you on a very lively program you did with our own Father Mitch, who tends to delve into these particular issues, has a special expertise as well. So tell me, why are you so interested in this particular topic?
Well, based on my own origin and background, my family comes from Egypt. I was born here in the States, and they're what's called Coptic Christians, the indigenous inhabitants of Egypt. I developed early on a very a personal interest in the sort of nexus or relationship between Muslims and Christians, mm-hmm. being a Christian, and my family's from the Muslim world. And so, and I learned the language Arabic and so forth. And then in college, I also studied it as well in the history. So mm-hmm. I majored in history, and my master's thesis was actually about the first battle between Muslims and Christians. And I used Greek, Byzantine sources, mm-hmm. as well as Arabic language sources. So both personally and professionally, I've had a long interest. And I also went and studied at Georgetown right. University, Catholic University.
Sure.
Definitely the personal side is what ultimately drives it.
Well, it was interesting, too, because in the foreword, Victor Davis Hanson, who you knew, and we can talk a little bit about that, talked about the idea that because of your knowledge and what you could do, you highlighted the fact of the filtered Islamic conversations that appear in English versus the way the fiery jihadism they spoke and composed in Arabic to inflame their own constituencies. And we'd see that sometimes. I remember mm-hmm. Years ago, there'd be a statement made, it sounded, you know, fairly innocuous, mm-hmm. and people would say, yeah, but that's not what he actually said.
Right. Yeah, that goes back, that actually is one of my earliest forms of writings and research, and mm-hmm. it goes back and manifested in 2007 with my first book, The Al-Qaeda Reader. That book was basically, I was working with Library of Congress, and I came across Arabic writings mm-hmm. by Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri that had never been translated. And when I read them, and then I compared them to what was being translated and disseminated on Western media, mm-hmm. they were completely different. What Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was saying is we have to hate them, non-Muslims, right. because they're infidels, et cetera, the Islamic State, ISIS kind of hate. Mm-hmm. But then when he was speaking to the West, it was, we're doing this to you because of your political positions, because you support Israel, because you hurt Muslims, and it was
you're
articulated.
The great Satan,
yeah, it was articulated in a way of, you know, we're hitting you because you're the bad guy,
right.
and
it's
you
your
hit
lousy
us first.
Culture that's impacting our yeah. people, and we're just trying
yeah.
to protect them.
But a lot of Westerners sort of understood and sympathized with mm-hmm. it. But I think what I was trying to show, and what I ultimately did show, is that the hate transcended right. all of those excuses. It was fundamental. It was inherent and was part of the religion.
Do you think the people who were propagating this kind of blander version mm-hmm. knew it was blander, or had they been bought into the idea that, no, this is really what they mean?
I think both. I think the majority, especially if you go back then a little post 2001, in 2010, I think most of them were naive. Mm-hmm. The academic departments, they're the ones that breed this naivety. Now, they may know better. So there's obviously some who know better, and there's some who get paid money to disseminate the falsehoods. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, if you look in academic books and scholars and the experts mm-hmm. on Islam, they're the ones who will tell you, no, Islam means peace. And people like Karen Armstrong, I think this, she's an ex-nun.
Right, you quote her yeah, as a pseudo-historian.
Yeah, she's a pseudo-historian. John Esposito as well at Georgetown University. The kind of image that they present of Islam is completely different than the radical Islam. Mm-hmm. But if you study, as I have, and you know the history and the language, and you can read the Quran, mm-hmm. actually, no. They're fabricating a Islam that suits Western sensibilities and telling us that's what it is, and the other thing is an aberration. It's actually the opposite.
Yeah, you talk about the successful propaganda of a radical Islamist ranging from Osama bin Laden concerning how the West totally today illegitimately occupies or controls land still belonging to various caliphates and sultanates of the past, because, and you, obviously you talk about Richard the Lionhearted in this, and the Crusades in the book, and there's always this sense, oh, we're going and conquering their land, but really it was a reconquest, right?
Well, yeah, that's the most fundamental aspect. I think it's the reason people have this skewed understanding of Islam vis-a-vis the West is every time we talk about the two civilizations from a historical point of view, it begins with the Crusades. Mm-hmm. and there's nothing told about the first four centuries. And so it appears as if everything was fine, and it's, again, John Esposito, I quote him, he's a professor at Georgetown, he says four centuries of peace elapsed before a papal power play basically mm-hmm. created the Crusades to go colonize the lands of, you know, brown people. That's the way they're presenting it. Lo and behold, as I describe in this book and in the one before, in the first four centuries, Islam exploded on the Christian world. And that's why a few people understand that North Africa, the Middle East, from Morocco to Egypt, to Syria, Lebanon, mm-hmm. Israel, it was called Greater Syria back then, Asia Minor, Turkey, all of that was not just Christian, that was the heart of the Christian world in the 7th century.
Read the New Testament, that's what they're talking
about. Most of Paul's letters are written to, you know, cities in Asia Minor, Turkey.
Right.
So few people realize that Muslims came and piecemeal conquered all of that territory, which if you look at a map, and other historians have basically said this, they swallowed up three quarters of the Christian world through violent conquest, through jihad. Mm-hmm. And the Crusades, you have to understand them, they come in that background. That's the context, that's the motivation. And right before the First Crusade in 1095, when Pope Urban II called it, there was a particularly horrific form of persecution of Eastern Christians, again, under this time, the latest iteration of Islamic terrorism, it was the Seljuk Turks. Mm-hmm. And they were running amok. And just according to the primary sources and contemporary accounts.
Which you rely on mostly, right?
Which I do.
What are primary sources?
Primary sources are where a historian gets his primary information. It's if I want to read something about, you know, the Crusades, well, I have to go collect all the oldest, most original writings of the Crusades I could find, ideally ones that were written at the time of the Crusades. And we have that.
Right.
So that would be the primary sources, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, as
it
were.
Right.
Unfortunately, too many people rely on popular secondary histories, which is a scholar or an academic purportedly takes these primary sources and then synthesizes them and explains to you what happened in accessible language. Mm-hmm. The problem is, and based on my comparison of the two, is they don't meet. Mm-hmm. There's a vast gulf. As I just explained, every book that starts from these secondary historians that starts with that's trying to talk about the conflict between the West and Islam starts with the Crusades, and not a word about four centuries of mass chaos. In Armenia alone, Eastern Armenia, which was greater at the time, the Seljuk Turks, according to primary sources, as in eyewitness accounts, slaughtered tens and thousands of Armenians, okay, and torched every church they could find. In Ani, which I believe was the capital at the time, mm-hmm. this is the 11th century, right before the Crusades, they torched, it was called the City of 1,000 Churches, and they torched every single one. And not just that, the Christian pilgrims who had long been going to the Holy Land before all this, were also being attacked in horrific ways, and I detail it. I mean, I make ISIS look like Boy Scouts, if you can imagine. Right. Just massacres and rapes and just torturing the pilgrims. So that's the backdrop of the First Crusade.
Yeah, young children being held over baptismal,
blood
and everything else.
Everything is very, very barbaric
stuff. Women being sold into slavery and things like that.
Just like ISIS. And they were doing it as well because that's what Islam is, or the way they articulate it.
Now, he talks about that your view is that you see the strife between the West, you know, this is and Islam as unending. The tenets of these two religions have for centuries been seen as incompatible. And given that Western pacifism has no counterpart in the Quran and the Hadith, mm-hmm. so there's no hope?
You know, look, if you're a person and you base your worldview on a book, let's say the Quran or the Bible, mm-hmm. okay, let's look at the Quran. And the Quran says X, Y, and Z, and X, Y, and Z happens to be antithetical to what the Bible says. So let's say in the New Testament you have treating people like, you know, love your neighbor. Treat them as yourself. Mm. Quran is continuously calling out hatred. It commands Muslims to hate non-Muslims. It even says if that Muslim is your father or brother or sister or wife, you have to hate them mm-hmm. because they're not Muslims. Okay, so it's very tribalistic in that sense. But if you're a pious Muslim or a pious Christian and you're trying to follow the commandments of your book, mm-hmm. obviously it's oil and water. These are not going to mix. Mm-hmm. If one book is saying love your neighbor, do good to those who persecute you, forgive them. And another book is all about, and it even allows lying and deceiving in the context of trying to conquer the infidel, because the infidel by nature is an enemy. You have to hate them just because they're not Muslim, no matter who they are. Like I said, it could be your father.
Right.
You have to,
You have that from John Adams and Thomas Jefferson talking about the Barbary Pirates. Like, why was it okay for you taking our people?
Yeah, and all the So this is right around 1800 before the first Barbary Wars, when so we're fast forwarding, but this is good because it gives you, it shows you the continuity. You know, so right from the explosion of Islam when it conquers Europe or the Christian world, and you fast forward now 12 centuries, and you have America just became a nation, just won the Revolutionary War, and now its vessels are being attacked by Muslims from Barbary, as they called it, North Africa. And they would enslave and torture the American sailors,
shores of Tripoli,
plunder them. That's where that comes from.
Right.
And then Thomas Jefferson and Adams met with the Barbary ambassador, and they basically, and keep in mind, these are the guys who wrote the Constitution and enlightened thinkers, and they're like, we've done nothing to you. We're willing to be your friend. Doesn't matter what your religion is or what ours, you know. And all the ambassador did is quote from the Quran. You are our enemies because you are not Muslims. It is our right given to us by Allah and the Prophet to kill, plunder you until we get, et cetera, et cetera. And I always chuckle to think what Thomas Jefferson must have thought at that response.
Right. He also points out, few now comprehend that many in the Muslim world would want no part of the westernized end of history. What was that, Fukuyama? Mm-hmm. Or our ecumenical vision of global harmonization. And you go on to say, there's a political as well as a historical message in these military biographies of the wartime careers of Christian resistance leaders to Islam. Eastern ideologies that demanding either their conversion, submission, or annihilation. And that you make the point, and he's making the point that you make here, that they were realists. They would like things to be different, but they understood what they really were.
Right. They were they couldn't live in an ideal world. They couldn't afford it the way we can. Okay. Because they were already, as I mentioned, most of the Christian world had been conquered. And even if you look at a map, there's a reason why when you look at a map, you see Europe, and then everything surrounding it is Islam, because that was former parts of Christian Europe. So, and it was a very real threat, and we'll get into it, but I mean, and people forget it. Spain entered through violence, and Islam entered through violence. Spain conquered it in 711 beginning and reached middle of France, Tours. And the Moors stayed in Spain for centuries. Okay, so once the Moors got their foot into Spain, it was centuries of nonstop warfare, the Reconquista, Reconquest, just to get them out, and so much bloodshed. So there were always all these Christians in pre-modern Europe. It was a very tenable and real urgent threat, the Islamic threat. They couldn't be idealists or pacifists.
Right, and you focus on eight quote-unquote Christian superheroes, so to speak, in a way. El Cid being one, obviously, falling right into that. But I was also wondering, with the idea that you're talking about, this is a follow-up or the next level of a book, Sword and the Scimitar. What was that book, and how do those relate to each other?
Sword and Scimitar is the previous book. It came out in 2018. This book, Defenders of the West, came out in 2022. Sword and Scimitar was more of a general history of the conflict between Christendom and Islam, beginning with the same time frame, really. It's very comprehensive. So it begins with from the time of Muhammad up until the Barbary Wars, as we were discussing. But that book looks at decisive battles. So each chapter is centers around a decisive battle that had a very oftentimes cataclysmic impact on either the Western Christian world or Islam. This book, instead of looking at eight decisive battles, I looked at eight decisive men.
Right.
And so this book is more about sort of the heart and the spirit behind the stalwart defenders who did fight in, again, you know, we always, when we think of these wars, we think of crusades. The crusades, the technical term, or the actual crusades, were a drop in the bucket compared to all the wars that Christians and Muslims had. Ideologically, most of them, the Muslims were approaching it from a jihadist paradigm, and the Christians were also approaching it from a just war theory.
You say, what did the West's past possess that its present, which seems to be far superior in every conceivable way, including militarily, does not? The answer is men who had something worth fighting for, from their faith and family in their countries and their cultures. And that's what this book is about. Eight men who are driven by something greater than themselves. And then you make the point that you would expect or think, well, how come there's not all these blockbuster movies turned about these people? And outside of El Cid in 1960 with Charlton Heston, and maybe a TV series later, which is probably tells the story differently than it was told back in 1960, we don't see these kinds of people, even Richard the Lionhearted, and of all people, mm-hmm. Vlad the Impaler. Yeah. So you can explain how he fit into this group, kind of the predecessor of the concept of Dracula, basically. Yeah. Why wouldn't these be popular today? Why wouldn't they make these superstar movies out of these particular people?
Because they're Christians and they were fighting on behalf of Christendom. Mm-hmm. And that's not something Hollywood's interested in. And the enemies are Muslims. And the aggressors are Muslims. So that completely, just throws a wrench in the dominant woke narrative that's emanating whether from Hollywood or any kind of media, right? Christians are obviously always the oppressors. They're the bad guys. They're burning witches and whatever,
right.
And everyone else is enlightened, like the Muslims, of course. So, to make a movie about the lives of these men, even though, as I say, if you read this book, especially, and again from the original sources, truth is stranger than fiction. Or in this case, it's much more dramatic than the movies that they make. But why won't they make these movies? And when they do, you mentioned El Cid with Charlton Heston in the '60s. You would think, well, back then they weren't politically correct. Well, actually, that movie doesn't really capture the truth. That movie is also a little whitewashed.
Right.
And it shows Muslims as sort of benevolent, and really the bad guys are, the Christian king. El Cid is sort of neutral, but he's open-minded.
Well, there's kind of good Muslims and bad
Muslims.
Right.
Which is okay as a principle, but in the context of these stories, they're definitely taking liberties, and again, it's from that. You're not going to have a Christian hero, especially one who's militant. That's the last thing you want, a guy who's militant
and Christian.
Well, that seems to be
your sense here of trying to deal with this kind of pacifistic imposition on Christianity and saying that's not really what the Christian faith was, certainly not for the first 1,500 years.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of people who are not Christians who want Christians to think that their religion begins and ends with them being doormats and turning the other cheek. And unfortunately, there's a lot of Christians who, whether they believe that sincerely or whether they just make a virtue out of a vice, namely cowardice, they also believe that's what Christianity is. You don't do anything. Mm-hmm. But that's not at all. That's not how these men understood it. And if they had understood it, there would not be no Western civilization. There would not be even Christianity, to be honest with you, at this point. And that's why I think the message of this book is dangerous, because it actually motivates men to take a more proactive stance and not just think that their religion begins and ends with them doing nothing except crying and turning the other cheek.
Well, another point you made in the book that I thought was interesting in the idea of looking at the Reformation and seeing that how it impacted our view of Islam. Explain.
Yeah, absolutely. The Reformation, was this great sundering of Christendom in Europe. It begins with Martin Luther, 16th century. And long story short is, in order to break away and essentially demonize the Catholic Church and legitimize themselves, Protestants, and this is just, a political fact, had to come up with whatever that makes Catholics look wrong or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so the Crusades became a perfect example. And all of a sudden, this is really where you get this idea that, the Muslims are the good guys, they're the noble guys, and it was the evil Crusaders.
Because of the Pope.
Anything that could be made and twisted, and that's where that theory comes. And it's also telling, I think, that Protestantism rooted itself in all those nations that had very little dealings with Islam. Okay, so the West.
They were the least impacted.
Yeah, they were the least impacted. So that's why today Protestant nations are the most open and sympathetic to Muslims, like, let's say, Scandinavia.
Right.
Because not only do they have a very, little history historically because of their distance, but because of that propaganda, that obviously Muslims are good because the only enemies they had were the evil Catholics, and we know that they're the bad guys. So they don't have that history to understand, and unfortunately, that's another side effect of Protestantism.
Well, a lot of it, sometimes I used to think of it, we think that sex, drugs, and rock and roll will take these people from being true believers to, they won't need this crutch anymore because they'll have enough money and they'll have enough sex and they'll have enough rock and roll and things will be good and they'll just be okay. And that's why they couldn't figure out how the 9/11 guys were who they were. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately a form of projecting. Mm-hmm. hedonistic, nihilistic Westerners projecting themselves onto others, and that just doesn't work. Right. Whether Muslims are right or wrong, they actually are following a more meaningful paradigm.
Right.
Okay, something grounded in God, in teachings, in morality, to a certain extent at least.
And when push comes to shove, they'll be willing to tell you, yes, that's very good, but...
Yeah, exactly.
But you plan on going to heaven, you have to become a Muslim.
Yeah. The Christians in this book who fought them, the Muslims fiercely respected them.
Yeah,
they hated them.
You talk about it.
They hated them, but they respected them.
Right.
Compare and contrast that with the Westerners who are doormats and appease and capitulate.
They have no respect for them.
They have no respect for them, and they say that, and I don't blame them.
Right. You know, it's interesting, even El Cid, right? The name, the Lord,
Lord, exactly.
Or the Lord.
He was
right?
pulverizing them, and El Cid means my Lord, the Lord,
right.
You know, like the master. That's right. He's known by an Arabic epithet from his enemies.
Right. Now, you talk about this book as being the idea of history as biography. What do you mean?
Well, that actually is an older school of thought of presenting history as, and it goes back to Thomas Carlyle, the historian, 19th century, and it's the idea that, it's actually the antithetical idea of how we understand history today. Today, it's the Marxist idea has sort of won out, which is a very materialistic view of history, which is anything and everything that happens is a byproduct of economic factors, okay? So if they're fighting, and they say it's about God or holy wars, that's the veneer. The reality is economic.
It's all about money.
Right.
Power.
Exactly. And that's unfortunately still the most dominant. The biography as history idea goes back to great men. And it believes in great men, which, of course, just in saying that, that's cringy to most people. What's a great man? Because we're used to our politicians who are nothing but great, obviously. But the idea was that great men they just made epics. And, so there was always the factors of change were always present. But it would always take a great man of genius or force or might or whatever, wisdom, to actually bring it all together. I think the men in this book do validate that to an extent.
Well, it's interesting too because you got Duke Godfrey, defender of Christ, Sepulcher, because you talk about how the church was destroyed and people don't understand, like you kind of alluded to before, going into Jerusalem. I mean, the whole idea was basically, torch the place, get rid of all anything that relates to Christianity.
Yeah.
And that was what. And in El Cid, you've got obviously somebody who stood up to his own king, right? Alfonso,
right.
Saying, "Did you kill your brother or not?" which put him on the bad side of that. So you're talking about somebody who obviously had moral fortitude. Mm-hmm. Then you got King Richard III. I didn't see Errol Flynn or Robin Hood in here, but it did talk about the Crusades. You think about these leaders, Barbarossa, obviously, Philip. But that whole idea of these people traveled from where they are all the way to the Holy Land at a time when this was a major, major inconvenience, especially for kings.
Yeah.
And their goal was to free the home of Christianity.
So noble. Noble, so altruistic, and yet they're so demonized for it.
Right.
Richard, for example, like you said, he was the king of England and portions of France as well.
He was tall.
He was.
No wonder they called him what he was.
6'6", 6'7".
Yeah, I mean, that was gigantic for that time.
And he was, Muslims were terrified of him.
Right.
I quote several sources of Muslims just when they see his banner, they would just flee, even the most ferocious jihadists. And he would throw himself in the thick of the fray and plunder it. Anyway, but the fact that men like that could have just sat at home and like his brother, King John, of course. But he actually gave up everything, went there, nearly lost his kingdom. And this is where Robin Hood and King John come in.
This is Leopold of Austria.
And John and Philip, the French king who basically betrayed Richard, were conniving to take over the kingdom and hand it to John. So many sacrifices, and yet it's amazing to see their descendants today, seeing them as just the exemplars of everything that's bad. They're the patriarchy, they're masculine toxicity, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's there too. And there's several others, St. Ferdinand, Savior of Spain, St. Louis, Christ, tragic hero. There's other ones, but I just wanted in our couple of closing minutes to talk about Vlad Dracula, the dread Lord Impaler. So he wasn't Bela Lugosi, he was somehow different than that?
Yeah, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah. So the story of Dracula that we know comes from Bram Stoker, and it was just a novel written in the late 1800s. And he based it, as many novelists do, on, there's some historical truth. So he based it on the atmosphere of Romania and a Romanian king. And it was Vlad III Dracula, and that is his real name. And what he was a noble from Wallachia, modern-day Romania, who was taken as a hostage, he and his brother, as young boys, I think 6 and 9, respectively. And his brother actually became a catamite to the Sultan, basically. And he was tortured and abused. And long story short, he made it back to his homeland and became the king, the equivalent of king, as they would call it. And he just had a feral hatred and fierceness against Islam after that. And no matter, even though the Ottoman Empire was a massive, powerful behemoth compared to his little area, and he would not bow his knee. And in one memorable moment, the Sultan sent emissaries to demand tribute in young boys because they used to take young Christian boys and turn them into Janissaries, forced Muslim jihadists.
Right.
And not only did he refuse it, but he told the emissaries, "Why haven't you removed your turbans? It's disrespectful." And they said, "Well, in our country, we have to do it." So he actually had his men nail the turbans on their heads and sent them back to the Sultan saying, "Well, from now on, keep your customs to yourself and leave our boys to us." So he's a very different guy. The story of him as being a bloodsucker is because he did impale his victims, which is another thing he learned from the Ottomans, because that's what they did, but we don't hear that part. So he was fighting fire with fire. He was always something like five, for every 20 men the Ottomans had, he had like three or five that were completely, had no weaponry or were fighting with pitchforks. So they had to take drastic measures, and they created the Forest of the Impaled, which was all these Ottomans who were impaled. And it was just fear tactics that was necessary.
Terrorism, basically.
It was terrorism.
In some way,
absolutely.
To scare people away.
Absolutely.
Right, so we're just out of time. Another book in the works?
Yeah, I have actually several that I'm thinking about, but a lot of people like this book, and my publisher's been talking to me, so I think another one's going to be very similar. It's a series, Sword and Scimitar is the battles. This is the heroes, and so we're going to be in something else historical.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Raymond Ibrahim.
Thanks, Doug.
Stopping by Bookmark and also Father Mitch's show, Defenders of the West, the Christian Heroes Who Stood Against Islam. Very interesting read. Bombardier Books available through our catalog. I'm Doug Keck. Thank you so much for joining us right here on EWTN's Bookmark.